welcome to the Total Soccer Show. My name is Taylor Rockwell. I am without any of my usual co-hosts today because instead I'm joined by an old friend to talk all things Bundesliga. It's Manuel Faith of Transfermarkt and the Gegenpressing Podcast. Manuel, great to talk to you again.
Oh man, it's so good to be back. And first of all, Happy New Year. Happy New Year to all the listeners. And yeah, I'm looking forward to this one. I think it's been too long and I'm excited to chat anything Bundesliga with you today.
Yeah, man. It has been too long. I'm excited to have you back. We've had a strange season. Not an unexpected season. Bayern Munich, top of the table, as always. But there have been some surprising results, surprising firings, surprising signings, lots and lots of things that we will get to today. But I want to start, since it's been a while since last we spoke, I initially planned to have you on in the winter break. Our schedule did not allow for that. My schedule did not allow for that. So here we are. But Manuel, my question for you to begin is there a favorite story of yours so far this season? Not necessarily like the happiest story or the most feel-good story, but just a topic that you think has been particularly interesting for whatever reason so far this campaign.
Wow, a favorite story for this campaign. I think and this goes really back to last summer, seeing the coaching carousel work out.
Yeah.
I thought that's been really interesting.
Let's talk about that. Let's talk about that coaching carousel for a minute. Because, I thought Jesse Marsch was going to be a great signing. And here we are, him no longer in charge. Marco Rosa, I thought, would just hit the ground running and Dortmund would look electric. And that has not quite been the case. The less said about Gladbach, the better. What has been most surprising to you about that coaching carousel so far?
Yeah, I think Jesse Marsch not working out. I was a bit surprised by that. I still think he's a great coach. A great person, by the way, as well. I really like him. And I think he was the right person at the right club at the wrong time in some ways. So I'm sure we'll talk about that in greater detail. And then I think Oliver Glasner, the way he's worked out at Frankfurt, they look like they won that carousel. If you can win a carousel, if there would be a race within a carousel, I guess they would win it. I think they look like they have done everything right in the summer. And it wasn't really by their own doing because they first lost Freddy Bobic to Hertha and then they lost Adi Hütter to Gladbach, right? And I understand Bobic's decision in a lot of ways. I think he felt that his work was done in Frankfurt, and I guess he's proven right in that sense. Adi Hütter's was a little bit more controversial, right? Because it seemed like at best a parallel move, and now it looks like a downward move in some ways because Frankfurt looked like in a way better position than Gladbach do. And Glasner has really done an excellent job to compensate not only the players that they lost, but also somewhat actually improving on the playing style that was already there. And I think that makes it a really intriguing story. They play really good football and they would have probably deserved the win against Dortmund on the weekend, right? And they have been for a while knocking on the door to get to the Champions League. And we've both been to Frankfurt, right? And been to a game there. And the atmosphere there is incredible when attendance is in the stadium. Probably the best in Germany, actually, in my opinion. And that club would just do fantastically well once they get to the Champions League, because I feel like that's the next, that would catapult them to become a consistent top four team in the Bundesliga, where they should probably be considering the size of the city, the financial power of the city, and the impact that the club has in terms of fan base, etc., right? So I think Glasner has done an excellent job. And I feel like they are my tip of all these teams that are currently sniffing around the Champions League spot. I think there's seven to actually make it and actually be a longer lasting sort of club that could actually establish themselves there and actually maybe become the third or fourth biggest team in Germany as a result.
Let's stick with Frankfurt then for a moment. They started the season in a rough spot. Even some speculation that maybe Oliver Glasner would be sacked or wouldn't be around for the whole season. They're knocked out of the cup. They win just one of their first 10. Now they're playing very well. I agree with you. I think it was harsh they don't end up winning. Credit to Dortmund for the fight back, but Eintracht Frankfurt looked all over them and looked comprehensively the better side, at least in that first half. How have they been able to turn it around? Was there a sort of turning point for this season or a particular player who has caught fire? And what do they need, do you think, to do either in the January window or beyond to be able to challenge for the top four or potentially even finish in the top four and qualify for the Champions League?
Yeah, I think what, I mean, in some ways, a lot of their business was done later, right? And so they needed to find some time to gel and get some pieces working. I think a couple players were also maybe disappointed that they didn't get the move that they thought they would be getting. Filip Kostić, for example, or Daichi Kamada, who now have looked really good. I think if you are a center forward and you're playing with Filip Kostić, that must be just a dream to be in the middle of the box, knowing that every delivery is just going to be perfect. Yeah. Look at, I mean, there isn't many players like that. And I think for Filip Kostić, there was a big disappointment because that was probably his last opportunity for a big move. And it didn't materialize for various reasons. Most of them, the fact that during COVID, clubs are just not willing to pay a lot of money, right? So I think he was a little bit in his head disappointed about it. But he's been excellent in the second half of the first half of the season. And you know, Rafael Borre took some time to get used to the Bundesliga. He scored twice against Dortmund. I think a lot of clubs around the world wanted him as a free agent signing from River Plate, right? And Frankfurt got him to replace André Silva. And they were totally different players. And so I think the rest of the squad needed to maybe adjust a little bit for him to be there because he's not that tall presence that André Silva is, right? He's a bit more of a compact forward. I'm still really much a box forward, but a little bit more compact. And I think that's just a different type of player that you have to deal with. But yeah, I think that just took some time to gel. And now with Kostić being, with the reality setting in for Kostić that Frankfurt is his home, and for some of these other players to finally, you know, getting adapted to their surroundings, I think they don't really need to do that much in the winter transfer window. I think maybe one thing, and this is, seems to be closely to be, there seems to be a resolution coming, is with what's going to happen with Amin Yunus, right? Who has been a constant pain, although he had a great first half of the year with the club. But he's been trying to strike his way out of the club, and there seems to be some sort of resolution for him. And then maybe it will be interesting to see if they can better integrate Jens-Peter Hauge into that squad as well. I think this is another guy that a lot of teams around the world wanted, and is going to be a very good addition for them, you know, once he gets used to it. And yeah, I think they don't need to do much. I think they just need to sort of do their homework and keep working and maybe not give away two goal leads.
That would be ideal. Certainly a good starting point. I don't know much about Amin Yunus aside from what his Wikipedia page, which I now have open, tells me. What's the drama there? What's the story there? Why do they need to move him on, or why does he want to move on?
Yeah, it's an interesting one because, you know, it's really kind of too bad because Amin Yunus is quite a good talent and a national team player was always a little bit of an enfant terrible, right? was once considered one of the brightest talents in German football. Came through the Gladbach ranks. Yeah. Had some personal problems there. Moved on to Kaiserslautern on loan. Didn't quite work out there. And Gladbach finally did sell him to Ajax, where he became a very important player, part of that Europa League run under Peter Bosz, where they lost to Manchester United in the final. And then went to Napoli, had a so-so time at Napoli, good and bad. And then Frankfurt signed him on loan. And his loan is supposed to expire next summer. And initially, it looked like he's going to find a long-term home in Frankfurt. But then he had an offer, I think, from Saudi Arabia. And that didn't go through. And then he went on strike. And yeah, It's a good example of a player being very jumpy in his career and seeking the next paycheck, I guess. And that's really too bad because, you know, he's a guy that wasn't in the vicinity of the German national team and certainly has the talent to be a German national team player, but very jumpy in his career. And at 28, it looks like whatever the resolution is going to be with his future, it's not going to be an upwards move. It's going to be at best a parallel move, probably more like a downward move, which is too bad. But you know, for Frankfurt, then for them, it will be the best to just find a resolution and move on in this sense, because that will settle the squad.
A squad that is mostly settled already, as you've said, currently in eighth place, but with the loss to Dortmund, they fall a little bit further back. Dortmund, meanwhile, closed the gap on Bayern Munich to 6 points. So we have somewhat of a title race. I want to stick with Dortmund for a second, because it feels like it's a good season for Dortmund so far, in that they are still within touching distance of Bayern Munich. But at the same time, like when we did the weekend review this weekend, talking about that game for Dortmund, it felt like Frankfurt were playing a sort of team-wide system and causing problems for Dortmund across the board. And when Dortmund were able to turn it around, it felt like it was because of individual performances, individual moments, and Frankfurt getting a little bit tired as the game went on. And so it still feels like this isn't necessarily a team that's functioning better than the sum of its parts. It feels like Marco Rosa still has his work cut out to get this team functioning the way they would need to challenge for the title. Am I being overly harsh on Dortmund, or is that roughly the vibe that you have towards them as well?
Yeah, that seems bang on.
Okay.
I think the...
You sound so sad about it.
Yeah, no, because I am really disappointed by them. And you're right, on paper, it's all good, at least in the Bundesliga. But I think...
Yeah, true.
As we've mentioned on Gegenpressing, and Stefan pointed this out, right? Stefan Bienkowski, who I do the Gegenpressing show with, pointed this out. It's almost like they get rescued by the individual brilliance rather than their tactical cohesiveness. Yeah. And... that's great in the Bundesliga against maybe in certain times, in certain, against a side like Frankfurt, who is just below them, right? Who they should be beating based on individual quality alone, because they have a ton of individual quality. You know, they're not far behind Bayern when it comes to individual quality. And so they should be beating these teams on a good day. But they get themselves into situations where it's not where their tactical problems create problems for them that, you know, they then need to solve by guys like Thorgan Hazard coming off the bench and putting in a one-man show, or like, yeah, Bellingham doing something brilliant, Erling Haaland doing something brilliant. Marco Reus, who's in my opinion been probably the best Borussia Dortmund player this year, has rescued them countless times. But it's not a unit that does it. It's a individual that just pops up and says, okay, puts up his sleeves and is like, well, I guess I'll have to rescue the team today. And that's, I think, where they get found out quite a bit. They got found out by Bayern. They got found out in the Champions League, right? Where the club fell to two teams that were coached better. And that's the reality of thing. I think Ten Hag is one of the best coaches in the game at the moment. Amorim, who coaches Sporting, is a very interesting name, and a name that has been linked even to the German teams at times this year. Was one of the guys that was possibly linked with Leipzig, right, to replace Jesse Marsch. And he's a brilliant coach, a brilliant young coach. And I think that who has a very bright future ahead of him, and he found out Rose as well. And I think that is something that where Dortmund, that's where their problems are, that there isn't whatever Rose wants to do with this club. It's not there yet. There's no, his fingerprints aren't there yet. And so it's not his tactics that are winning games. It's the players who are winning games. And that is, in my opinion, a huge problem.
What do you think Marco Rosa wants to do? What does it look like if his fingerprints are more on this team than it does right now?
Yeah, that's a very good question. I would like to have the answer for that as well. And because we don't know, I can't see it yet. And we have to go back to possibly his time at Salzburg, right? Where there was a very aggressive counter-pressing style of play, where they played very attractive football. But as we found out in the past, the transition from Salzburg to the Bundesliga isn't always easy. At Gladbach, you saw it at times in the first season, but we didn't see it much in the second season. And in particularly after he announced that he would be leaving Gladbach for Dortmund, right? He and Gladbach were in all sorts of trouble. So I'm not sure that with the squad that they have at the moment, they can even play his style of game. Remember at Gladbach, they had almost this three-line forward system with the 4-3-3. And without a typical number nine, because Mbolo, Thuram, and Player, they're not all typical number nines, and they were almost playing like a very high press with flexible attacking players that could play all sorts of formations. Then he comes to Dortmund, and yes, he's worked with Erling Haaland in the past, right? But he comes to Dortmund, and all of a sudden, you have a number nine, a full-on number nine. And it seemed like at times, in the first half of the season, the tactic was simply punt the ball up high, hope that Haaland does the rest, right? And then when Haaland went out injured, I actually thought they played some of the better football without him. And that sounds harsh. Don't get me wrong. I think Haaland is a brilliant player. But it was almost like the attacking line seemed to be more suited to what Rose wants to do with these, you know, with more flexible attacking players, with an attack that is more variant, has more variance to it. And yeah, I think that's maybe what we will see eventually from them, if he gets the chance to actually implement it. It's like a more progressive attacking 4-3-3 with a flexible attacking line that sees players moving throughout different positions. And is defensively, and this is the most important part, is just a bit more sound. And I think to be able to achieve that, they will have to make some changes to the squad.
Could one of those changes be selling Erling Haaland? I know that there's the buyout clause. Mm-hmm. I know that he's very likely to move. But if we're saying that this is a Dortmund team that are maybe overly reliant on individuals, I would assume Erling Haaland would be one of those individuals that he might not fit the system or might not be a flexible enough option. Is there a world in which for Marco Rosa selling Erling Haaland and then reinvesting that in two or three very good players is sort of what's needed to move Dortmund on?
It's a predicament, isn't it?
It really is, because that feels odd to say about a player who is as freakishly good as Erling Haaland.
Yeah, it is. It is a difficult one because he will make you better, mm-hmm. without a doubt. And I can't remember. I've been trying to find the statistic, but there was some crazy number that floated around earlier in this season that Dortmund actually, without Haaland, scored more goals than with him, even though he, on average, produced more points for them. I couldn't find it again, so if someone can find it and see it, it'd be great to point it out to me. But that's like the sort of thing that you find and see, right? I think if Haaland moves on, and I know Dortmund are working very hard to sign him to a new contract, and I know COVID makes it very difficult for various clubs to buy him. Although I think when what you hear from behind the scenes, he seems to have his future more or less figured out, and Real Madrid is the club I'm being pointed towards. Whether that's coming to fruition or not, we'll see, right? But that's the club that is being pointed out to me, that they're going to sign Mbappe and Haaland and shock the football world, that sort of thing. So if they lose him and the exit clause is somewhere between 70 and 90 million euros, depending on who's going to sign him, which I find interesting because it's everyone assumes it's a set exit clause, but apparently it depends on who actually does the transfer. That money, you know, some of that money is earmarked for Adeyemi, who's coming from Salzburg. And I hope that a lot of that money is earmarked for a defender, because Mats Hummels has been a train wreck for them. And so has Emre Can, who's just not a center back. I thought he could be a solution at center back. He's not. And just to bring a bit more stability. And then, of course, Donil Malen is very much a transfer that they had in mind for already next year. So he's getting integrated into the system. So all of a sudden you have Donil Malen, Yusufu Moukoko, who's still coming up there, the squad, right? And Adeyemi. And that's his three flexible attackers right there.
Where does Gio Reyna fit into that, assuming he is one day healthy and able to play again?
Yeah, that's a good question, right? Because he is never healthy. And
this is the concern.
Yeah, it is a concern. I think that's something that also his father had problems with, right?
Yep.
And unfortunately, these things are genetic. you have guys out there who just never get hurt. Look at Thomas Müller. Guy was just unbreakable, it seems. And so that determines whether your career or not is going to be a huge success or just a success. And I think getting him fit and giving him his body the stability it needs to be a successful long-term player at this level is going to be a huge task for both Gio Reyna, but also Borussia Dortmund. And he's very important for them when he's fit. There is no doubt about it because he gives them an attacking flexibility that, adds a nuance to their game that you can't find otherwise. There is no other player like that in the system, right? Marco Reus and Thorgan Hazard. Thorgan Hazard is a very direct attacking midfielder. Marco Reus is in some ways, a little bit more of an inverted attacker, right, rather than a number 10. And Gio Reyna is that number 10. And so he gives them that extra little bit that they need. So yeah, I think for them, it's very important to get him fit. And I think for, in the long term, getting him fit and getting him integrated into the system and, is of utmost importance because for that 4-3-3 to work, remember Lars Stindl was a very important part of the Gladbach system, right behind these two flexible attackers at times. And that's where I would see Gio Reyna play for Dortmund.
This episode is supported by FX's Welcome to Wrexham. Celebrity owners Rob McElhenney and Ryan Reynolds' small-town Welsh football club has finally been promoted into League 2 after 15 seasons in the National League. Dedicated staff and supporters celebrate the city's return to glory while bracing for the newfound challenges that come with being in a higher league. Will Wrexham AFC stand up to the challenge and rise again into League One? FX's Welcome to Wrexham premieres May 2nd on FX. Stream on Hulu.
This episode is brought to you by Michelob Ultra, the official beer sponsor of the NBA. Want to get closer to the game than ever before? Michelob Ultra Courtside is giving fans the chance to win exclusive NBA prizes and experiences like official gear, courtside seats to an NBA game, and more. Head over to MichelobUltra.com/courtside to learn more.
So it seems like Reyna is in the plans, provided he's healthy. We're not sure about Erling Haaland. They're trying to renew him, but it also feels like he may end up moving this summer. Very unlikely he moves in January, but maybe this summer.
No, that's not
there
happening.
There we go.
Not January. Big names like that don't move in January. I think there's talk scheduled for during this month between Dortmund and Haaland to determine his future next summer. And so we'll probably find out sooner rather than later what direction he's going to go.
As you said, it's a fluctuating buyout clause. I'm assuming it would be less expensive if Real Madrid tried to sign him versus, say, Bayern Munich, a club that I still feel like might be in for him in the end. If you're ranking his most likely destinations, it feels like Madrid is one. I know Barcelona tends to be in that conversation. I still don't know how that would work for them financially, but I feel like it's Bayern Munich as two if we're talking about his most likely destinations, and maybe Dortmund is third.
I personally would hate that move.
Yeah, I figured.
I don't think it would be good for the league. It would not be good for the Bundesliga's name. I would understand why Bayern would do it. I think there's two sides to the story is that Bayern Munich do not care what other people think about them or what is good for the league or what it does to the reputation. That is not to their concern. They're playing a different competition with the rest of the world. Right. They are maybe at the moment together with Real Madrid, the biggest club in the world. And, so for them, that's where they see themselves competitively and they have to do everything in their power to stay there because they can't just go and, call some guy in Abu Dhabi and get more money. That's not how this works. So if they can sign someone like Erling Haaland, to a package deal like this, they will do it. If it's financially possible, they will do it. That's, I think, the more important question when you hear about Oliver Kahn and Hasan Salihamidžić will be all over it. I think the guy that's more careful about this is Oliver Kahn. He's very much in charge of the finances now, right? The CEO of Bayern Munich, and very guarded when it comes to future investment. And I think when you talk to Hassan, they will do everything in the power to do it. And if you talk to Oliver Kahn, he will say, you hear the numbers, somewhere between 40 and 50 million euros a year to sign him, right? And then you have to add the 90 million euros on top of that, that Borussia Dortmund want as part of the exit clause. That's a lot of money. That's twice the salary that Robert Lewandowski is on at the moment. And, you know, that's that. I think Kahn will be very careful and guarded about this one. I think for them, and you see this with the Kingsley Coman deal, right? That was announced today. Which I think is actually a very interesting contract renewal, because there was a lot of talk that it wouldn't happen because he asked for a lot of money. But at the end of the day, he's earning about 17 million euros a season before tax. So about 8 to 9 million after tax. And you include bonuses and everything and the length of the contract, that's about 100 million euros. Try to find a player for that price category. You know, it's very difficult to replace Kingsley Coman, for example. You would have to sign Ousmane Dembele. His contract demands are 43 million a year. You're just not going to do that. And so to swing back to Erling Haaland, you're in the same category. For Bayern, it might be simply cheaper to renew with Robert Lewandowski and go with what you have and just hope that further down the line you find some guy who can replicate that kind of goal scoring or you make it as part of a collective, because for them that's a lot of money, and again they have to generate that money themselves, and they're losing between 3 and 4 million euros a game right now because of closed doors, because of the games being played behind closed doors, right? They can do it financially because they're filthy rich, but it's also something that you have in the back of your mind as a club, right?
I mean, I would assume you have to. But Bayern maybe less so than other clubs for reasons you've already mentioned. So potential transfers and renewals aside, how are you feeling, or how would you sort of grade the season so far for Bayern Munich? They're top of the table, still alive in the Champions League, out of the DFB Pokal. How has this first season been under Julian Nagelsmann?
I think they've been very good. And I think the Champions League in particular, they were excellent. And I think then, and oftentimes that's probably the easiest competition for them to be in. I think they have a lot more trouble in the Bundesliga than they have in the Champions League at times, which is something, of course, that the Bayern Bundesliga is a Bayern only league brigade doesn't want to hear, but it's true. They've have a much easier time there than they have in Germany. And, I think that's the benchmark for them, right? 18 points out of 18 points in the group. We're fantastic in the group as well. And when you look at the troubles that they had throughout the season with COVID, you know, with the Joshua Kimmich story, the fact that there were so many players unvaccinated, and the fact that this is, I found that actually was a really interesting story, in part of because how many people knew about which players were unvaccinated at Bayern. I found out I went back in September, October, right? There was a brief window where travel was possible, and I went because I didn't know when it was possible again. And I spent quite a lot of time with people who cover the club quite closely, and spent some time with Bayern Munich in particular. And very quickly, I learned that there was 4 players who weren't vaccinated, and I got the names. But, you know, releasing health data in Germany is quite tricky. So you can have it, but you can't do anything with it. And when Bild released that story about Kimmich, I was like, okay, well, I know who the other 3 guys are, and I wonder when they're going to release that. It seemed like almost like they were doing it piece by piece, right? That he was unvaccinated. I thought that was very interesting how that was handled, because it wasn't actually Bild Sport that did it. It was Bild Politics, because that way the sport guys could sort of like wash their hands clean and wouldn't get in trouble with the club. I thought that was actually a really interesting story. It shows you quite a bit of how the club is covered and how much information our journalists have, and how little we can actually use sometimes, because it's just not something we are allowed to run, right? And then, of course, when one person runs it, we're like, okay, yeah, this is what it is. This is the actual story. Let's go, because it's already out there. It's come public knowledge now, right? I thought that was really interesting. Yeah. But I actually thought that had a really good chance of torpedoing Bayern's season. The whole COVID story and the fact that Kimmich A wasn't unvaccinated and had his concerns, right? I need to point out that some of the other guys, Jamal Musiala was one of the players who wasn't vaccinated, but his age category only came up, right, in September. He wasn't actually eligible for vaccination before. And then he said, okay, well, I wait till Christmas in terms of the side effects and I miss time. So fair enough. I get that. There's nuance to every story. And then, of course, Kimmich gets the virus just before he decides to get vaccinated. And then he's out for several weeks. And during that time, Dortmund failed to capitalize. And I think considering that background noise, it's actually been a very good season for Bayern, because that was a very difficult period for them. And it was a period where Dortmund could have maybe gone 3-4 points clear at the top of the table, and it didn't, which actually shows you quite a lot on how well Julian Nagelsmann handled that situation.
Yeah, I think you've answered it there. But a follow-up question I had, is this, with the kind of continued success that Bayern have had so far this season, is that more of a credit to Julian Nagelsmann and how good of a manager he is that he hasn't had the sort of Niko Kovac situation? Or is it more to you a sign of just how consistent Bayern Munich as a club is when it comes to making these kind of results happen, keeping things consistent, winning silverware, being Bayern Munich?
Oh, there's a lot there.
It seems to be how my questions go. There's a lot there.
I think Nagelsmann has handled a very, very difficult period of transition very well.
Does I feel like you're sense? Answering it very diplomatically. Yeah, yeah, that makes sense. How actually, let me ask you this then. How different is it for you covering sports and the way you have to report on sports or anything in Canada versus Germany? Because it's interesting that you mentioned the sort of requirements and some of the standards for reporting. And it's a thing we bump into a little bit on the Total Soccer Show, because we have Ryan and Graham, who are Brits. There are more sort of rules in place about what can and can't be said that sometimes comes across, I think, for people as like, oh, you're just trying not to make people mad or not sort of like instill it, like create any bad blood between this club and yourself. And really, it's more of a like, no, I'm trying not to get sued. So how different is it for you reporting in Germany versus reporting in Canada?
And the sort of bridging all these different cultures, right? Because like I also do a lot of US stuff, and in Germany it's quite open, I would say. The only thing is depth here. Journalism standards, you often in interviews in Germany have to be, you don't own the interview until the interview has been cleared with the player, person, etc., who you're talking to in Germany, right? So let's say, for example, I do an interview with Oliver Kahn. I interview him, and then I write the text. The text remains his possession until he clears it.
Wow.
Right? That said, this is happening more and more in Canada too. But when I deal with US clubs, which I often do as well, that's not the case. Unless it's a German player playing for a US club.
A lot of calculations.
Which I also often do, right? So it's very interesting, because you have to deal with a lot of different press standards, in my situation at least, because I operate full-on in Canada, I operate full-on in Germany, but I also fully in the US. And I find the press standards are very different. And generally speaking, when I do an interview, I think it's important that you quote the person the right way. It's part of your story. Because an interview is different in that sense, right? That it's very personal, and it's a person trying to tell his story. And I'm just there to be the conduit for it. And so I think it's actually kind of important that you ensure that what they are saying is the right thing. You don't want to backstab someone. So I think in that sense, it actually makes sense to actually work with that person, because you don't own that article. It's that person's article, and I'm just have the privilege to host it on whatever outlet I write on, right? So I actually think that's not a bad policy, and you need to work with these people long term. This is the other thing that you have to remember, right? These people are some, you know, these contacts that you make, they exist for your entire life. So you can't burn any bridges. As in terms of getting a breaking story, I don't have any personal gains to break that Joshua Kimmich is unvaccinated. That's not my story to tell. That's not why I'm in the sport. I have very strong opinions about vaccinations. You know that we've talked about this in private. I believe that if you have the opportunity to get vaccinated, you should. It's not for yourself. It's for everyone around you. But I am not here to tell Joshua Kimmich what he should do with his body. That's not my place. So it's like, this is not my story to tell. If Bild release it, of course, it becomes part of the general knowledge, then I will report on it. So it is difficult. You're bridging different cultural journalism standards, right? And at Bayern Munich, there's a ton of stuff that we know, that we don't report or wait for the right moment. And it's the same with other clubs that I report on that. And I find like the more you know, the less you can report.
It does. Makes sense. It definitely does. So it seems, you know, it seems like caution is your best sort of, approach.
Yeah, I mean, because it can really backfire, and people take it very personal when you report something and doesn't quite work out that way. The Ricardo Pepi one is a good example. People got really upset because I said, okay, according to our information, it's now been confirmed that Wolfsburg are the club that will sign him. I had that from two very good sources that deal was done. And while at the same time, I was stressing on a show that nothing is done until the guy holds up his shirt at the press conference.
And even then, sometimes that's not even enough. Yeah.
And even then, you know, like freaking Ross Barkley crawled out of an MRI machine, you know?
I do know what you mean? Yeah.
So things change, and we don't report stuff for our personal gain. And when we report something, it's because the information is good.
Yeah.
Right. And there's a lot of stuff that I know. There's about 5 or 6 transfers that I know that will happen that I can't report on for various reasons. And I will not. You know, that's just, I would have maybe 3 or 4 years ago, but now I can't anymore because sometimes your information is something that you have to sit on for a while. Like the whole Bradley Carnell going to St. Louis. I've known that for 5 months.
Really?
But yeah, that was not a secret. And I said, and you know this, I know Lutz Pfannenstiel very well. And I said to Lutz, when you guys are close to making this official, I want the first exclusive interview. Because that was a better story than breaking it. To give you a good example.
Did that work out for you?
Right.
All right.
It worked out. It was great. I got a good exclusive interview with them. I did it the night before the announcement, and Transfermarkt was the first exclusive interview, and it was a great article and was very popular. It was well received. 100%
it was worth it. So we've learned Manuel does not want to burn his bridges. I think that is a very good approach, but I'm going to try to get you to do so by asking you more questions about Augsburg now. I thought your conversation about Ricardo Pepi's move to Augsburg was really, really interesting on the Gegen Pressing podcast. A thing I thought was particularly interesting was your conversation about Augsburg itself. And I think I'll speak for me, but I think for a lot of folks, we don't really think about the city where the player is going and the sort of culture they're moving to. We just think about, are they going to work on the field? How's that going to fit? And it's interesting when you have a youngster like Ricardo Pepi moving to Germany, to the Bundesliga. I think people think Munich. I think they think Berlin. I don't think they think Augsburg as much. What is Augsburg like? What do you think Ricardo Pepi is going to be sort of getting into when he moves there?
Yeah, Augsburg is great. It's a 45-minute train ride from
that's
Munich.
Why it's great, because it's relatively close to Munich. That's all it takes. I got you.
No, I'm being uh-huh. harsh. My blue heart is shining through here. My 1860 heart. It's a very beautiful city. It's a very old city. It's older than the city of Munich. It's the old capital of the German Reich. When you go all the way back, it's the seat of the Fugger, which used to be a big trading family, right? Which is why the club is called the Fuggerstädter. And when you look that up, I think there was even a computer game where you could be a Fugger trader and trade things and all that sort of stuff that came out in the 1990s. So it's a very, very old city. And it's very, very medieval. The inner city is very medieval. It's beautiful, without a doubt. It's very close to Munich. Of course, it gets overshadowed by the city of Munich quite a bit, because Munich is now the big capital in Bavaria, right? And although Augsburg is Swabian, so, you know, like across the border in Baden-Württemberg, where they are Baden and Badensers and Swabians, it's part of Bavaria. And sort of the third city in Bavaria, right, after Munich and Nuremberg. Nuremberg is, of course, also a very large city. And in terms of FC Augsburg, there's a club that's in its current form, although they're saying they were founded in 1907, in its current form, they've existed since the 1960s. And interestingly enough, they actually hold the record for the biggest attendance in the Zweite Bundesliga. This was a game in Munich against 1860, my club, where they had 90,000 people in the Olympiastadion for this game. So, you know, there is a bit of history there. But in terms of their Bundesliga history, they're a very new club. They came up and everyone expected them to go down. And then every year since they've been up, and it's been 7 years now, everyone expects them to go down and they just don't want to go away. And which is it's very funny, because I think a lot of fans from other Bundesliga teams sort of see them as the club that we don't need in the league. And, you know, they'd rather have someone like Hamburg or Schalke or Werder Bremen back than Augsburg. But, you know, like that little village in Asterix and Obelix, they just don't want to go away. And they've been around ever since. And, you know, that speaks for them, because they are well run behind closed doors. And they have been well run ever since, and have done a lot with what has been limited financial abilities, because that seems
Let's
to change
Let's talk about
a little
that
bit.
Then. Do you think they do have aspirations for bigger and better things with this signing of Ricardo Pepi? Do you think that signifies more signings to come and a strengthening of the squad, or is this more of a one-time investment that they expect to pay off at some point down the road?
Yeah, actually, it's really interesting, because after the transfer happened to Augsburg, I made some calls to people, and I was told the reason Augsburg got Ricardo Pepi from Dallas, first of all, because they outbid Wolfsburg by a good €8 million, so that helps. But also because, unlike Bayern Munich, who were sniffing around until the very end, they were willing to put a lot of clauses into that contract, into that €18 million deal. And, you know, like a sell-on clause, future incentives, all that sort of stuff, which Bayern didn't necessarily want to do. And also, of course, Dallas knew that if he ends up with Bayern, that's probably the end of the road for him. You know, where do you go after that? To the moon? Like, that's it. You know, there is no better destination after that. Whereas if he goes to Augsburg, a future transfer is in the cards, which means Dallas will earn extra incentives on top of what they've already earned. Which is very important, I think, for them. And anyone who knows Dallas, that's a big part of the way they run. And that's, you know, one big reason why they got him. I think if Ricardo Pepi had been in the equivalent forward and had a Brazilian passport, this transfer never happens.
Really? Interesting.
Because of the investor, mm-hmm. David Esplitzer, right? And I don't want to say David Esplitzer financed this deal directly, but I think he's involved in the strategic decision to make this deal happen. In terms of, you know, we want to grow in the US, we want to have a bigger footprint in the US. Augsburg have been very actively looking to you know, established themselves in North America. I think there will be a lot more coming in the future in terms of maybe them coming over here for games, maybe them to establish themselves in terms of having a front office, like Bayern Frankfurt have in Nuremberg, right? In New York. And so you will see like things like that. But first and foremost, they have to stay in the league because that's not a given at the moment, because I think anyone who's above them right now is better than they are. Every single one of them are better teams than they are. Stuttgart, Wolfsburg, Hertha, Gladbach, you know, are the teams immediately in front of them. I think Augsburg are better than Bielefeld and Fürth, but only just. And so they have work to do to stay in the league, because having the strategic decision to sign someone to grow an American market means nothing if you play in the second division the year after.
Yeah. And that's true.
That's, I think, really, that's going to be, that makes it interesting what's going to happen for the rest of this winter, the rest of January, because they have to do things. They have to strengthen their midfield. They have to strengthen their wings. They have to maybe, Florian Niederlechner has been linked to Chicago Fire, for example. I could see them, you know, maybe moving him on to create some room and bringing in some players. I mean, they have to do stuff. They have to, because, you know, Ricardo Pepi is not going to fix their problems overnight.
Yeah, so with that in mind, if they needed to make a signing or a couple signings, they still need to make a couple signings, and they wanted to have more of a footprint in the American market, does Ricardo Pepi at the very least like serve a function within this team as it presently exists? Because I think the reporting has been, it makes sense with the amount spent on him. He is going to get minutes. He's going to get opportunities. And the question then becomes, will they be service? Will he have actual goal scoring chances? But I think my larger question for you, Manuel, was he the right signing? If they wanted to make an impact and bring in an American that they could afford, I doubt they're going to be able to bring in Tyler Adams or Christian Pulisic or something like that. But do you think he was the right signing for them for trying to make that impact while at the same time getting good results, getting goals, making things happen this season?
That's a fine line between the hype,
the
hype train. Their social media presence has been very active in that regard. And Ricardo Pepi's agency has also worked really hard to make sure that this is going to be frontline news all over the place by, you know, selectively working with groups of journalists to ensure that this got a lot of hype. And I think that's a fine line. On the one hand, you want this sort of hype in order for the transfer to have the sort of impact that you need on the American market. On the other hand, we're talking about a 19-year-old guy here who's for the first time in his career has moved to a different country, and a very different country. You know, Augsburg is very different than Dallas. And I think for Americans in general, it's pretty easy to make the transitions to Germany, more so than many other nationalities. That's why we see so many of them in the Bundesliga. But it's still different, you know, for a teenager to be in Germany rather than in Dallas with the family and all that. So I think it's a fine line for Augsburg that they're walking there. And to also remember that Ricardo Pepi on his own is not going to solve their problems in attack, in midfield, and defense. And I mean, you see, they were heavily linked to Jens Stage, a Danish midfielder. They have been linked to Kevin Vogt, a defender, who I heard actually had an offer from MLS club as well. I found that out today. But that didn't materialize because Hoffenheim didn't want to sell him. But yeah, it's going to be interesting to see what else they're going to do. I think they need to bring in another serviceman, because then Ricardo Pepi on his own is not going to solve the problems. And Ricardo Pepi is not going to score the goals for them unless he's help up front.
And if they do bring in more people, maybe Blitzer will be involved in some of those acquisitions and fronting some of the money. Which gets to the idea of investors in a world where 50 plus one reigns supreme. Can you talk or can you explain how private investment, say, factored into Pepe's signing and why it is a source of debate in Germany? Because it's a thing that I was very much not familiar with until this transfer, and now seems to be at the front and center of discussions about how the Bundesliga is going to expand or find competition for, say, Bayern Munich, something like that.
Yeah, it's, I think investors have finally found a loophole in 50 plus one. And it's going to be interesting to see how that's going to impact further money coming to Germany down the road. I know that American investors have been eyeballing the Bundesliga for a long time because it seemed to be the one league that they really couldn't get their foot in the door, right? And you see a lot of money going into Italy at the moment from American investors. That's not quite the case yet in Germany. And Augsburg, together with Hertha Berlin, where something similar is going on, with a German investor in this case, have sort of offered the blueprint of how you can keep 50+1, but also opening the doors to investors. And the principle is quite simple. At the base of every club in Germany is the so-called eingetragener Verein, the membership club, right? The membership club like you have in Spain and in a lot of South American countries. No one can buy any shares in that. So what every club in Germany has done, or most clubs, Schalke is an exception of this rule, they have either a chair company, a limited chair company, or a joint stock company, or any kind of like financial structure that has been sort of outsourced, right? And that club owns and operates the football operations of the first team, sometimes the first team, the second team, and some of the youth teams. To a certain level, usually U19. And that operation is free to sell shares, right? In Augsburg's case, 99.5% of those shares are owned by Klaus Holtmann, who was also the president of the club. And he has then sold, through his holding company, 45% of his shares to Blitzer. The reason why 50+1 remains intact is because those are not voting shares. 50+1 of the voting shares remain with the eingetragener Verein. So the membership club still sends, let's say you have a board of 10 people, there will be six members of the board will still be voted in by the membership club. So 50+1 remains intact, but someone can still own a significant percentage of the football operations of that club, right? And Hertha sort of did this. Well, Hertha technically did it second. First, the first team to do this was 1860 with Hasan Ismail, and it wasn't really a success because the investor was very difficult to deal with. And 1860 had to use 50+1 many times to sort of torpedo ideas by the investor. The second club to do it with a bit more success has been Hertha with Windhorst, who has pumped 350 million euros in the club and owns 60% of the operations that run the football operations, right? And so it looks like Augsburg are going down a similar path. And I've now hearing rumbling that there's a few other Bundesliga teams. Yeah, Max Eberl, for example, from Borussia Mönchengladbach has said that they are looking for investors as well. So it looks like this sort of structures open the doors to keep 50+1 intact on paper, to ensure that the fans have still the majority of the voting share, but at the same time, investors can come in and say, I want to buy 60% of your club.
And then it stands to reason the fans theoretically can still oppose things that are happening, can still vote things down. It just requires all of them to be together versus if you have basically the rich people saying, this is how we want it to be. It stands to reason you're going to get a few people on your side and you'll be able to push it through. Is that roughly how it would work? Okay.
In theory, at the end of the day, in German we have a saying, "Wer zahlt, schafft an." The person who pays makes the decisions. And I personally believe in that. I think in theory, yes, the fans still have the power to veto certain things, like a name change, like a stadium move, things like the Super League, right? Sort of those sort of things would never happen in German football, even with this sort of structure in place. But at the end of the day, if your American investor wants the club to pay $20 million for an American 19-year-old American striker, it will do it because that's where the money is from. Right?
I think I just assumed that it would be unpopular because it does sort of get around 50+1. Yeah. But is it more accepted because it's seen as a way to combat, say, Bayern Munich's dominance or even some of the larger clubs who don't have to worry about things like Augsburg does or Hertha certainly has it in the past? Like, is it a more popularly held thing because it allows theoretically for greater competition?
I think Augsburg are very lucky that stadiums are close to fans at the moment. I think there is a lot of debate on social media. There's a lot of debate on various forums, but you're not seeing the signs in stadiums because COVID is shutting the fans out. And that, I think, might be for some teams an opportune time to bring this sort of thing in and, you know, change the structure. Because you're not going to see tennis balls flying on the pitch right now, are you?
If you do, it's something weird has happened. Yes, I take your point. Yeah.
Yeah. You know, like the tennis ball protests, of course, was with the Monday night games in German football that were heavily opposed by fans and eventually forced the league to actually cancel them because they were so heavily opposed. Because then fans started throwing tennis balls onto the field for every game. Funny protest, really, really creative. I thought it was hilarious. But you're not going to see that right now. You're not going to see fan protests because there are no fans. And the cynic in me is saying this is the greatest time for any executive to make unpopular decisions because who's going to oppose you?
Today's episode is brought to you by Shopify. On the Total Soccer Show, we often talk about the importance of a manager who can clearly and effectively communicate their tactics and then a squad of players capable of executing that approach, but also adding some individual flair along the way. And that's the same relationship you're getting with Shopify. You tell them how you want things to work or what you need to get done, and they execute the game plan, sometimes even better than you could have expected, with Shopify Magic, their AI-powered all-star. Shopify is the global commerce platform that helps you sell at every stage of your business, from the launch your online shop stage to the first real store stage, all the way to the did we just hit over a million orders stage? Shopify is there to help you grow. From what I've heard from family members who use Shopify for their online store, which has evolved into an amazing brick-and-mortar location, Shopify has helped with that growth, and with every step along the way, they've made it easier to process and track orders, run the business day-to-day, and help with long-term growth as well. So whether you're auctioning autographed jerseys or selling custom stadium prints, both of which are awesome, Shopify helps you sell everywhere. From their all-in-one e-commerce platform to their in-person POS system, wherever and whatever you're selling, Shopify's got you covered. Shopify helps you turn browsers into buyers with the internet's best converting checkout, up to 36% compared to other leading commerce platforms. And you can sell more with less effort thanks to Shopify Magic, the aforementioned AI-powered all-star. Shopify powers 10% of all e-commerce in the United States and is the global force behind Allbirds, Rothy's, Brooklinen, and millions of other entrepreneurs of every size across 175 countries. Plus, their extensive help resources are there to support your success every step of the way because businesses that grow grow with Shopify. Sign up for a $1 per month trial at shopify.com/TSS. That's all lowercase. Go to shopify.com/TSS now to grow your business, no matter what stage you're in. One more time, all lowercase. That's shopify.com/TSS.
This episode is brought to you by Michelob Ultra, the official beer sponsor of the NBA. Want to get closer to the game than ever before? Michelob Ultra Courtside is giving fans the chance to win exclusive NBA prizes and experiences like official gear, courtside seats to an NBA game, and more. Head over to MichelobUltra.com/courtside to learn more.
Well, let me take it this direction then. In terms of popular decisions, I would say it stands to reason that Freiburg and Hoffenheim are both fairly popular with their supporter groups. Which of those two teams has been the bigger surprise for you, given where they are in the table at time of recording?
So we actually spend quite a bit of time talking about Freiburg throughout the year because I think it's just remarkable what they do every year. And Christian Streich is a gem of a head coach. I think he is an institution in German football, and he makes everything in German football better. His existence alone, and the fact that he speaks out on cultural and political important things, just make him a very important person. Which also means this club gets a lot more attention at times, and I feel bad for Hoffenheim because we haven't really talked much about them. As a result, and here they are, silently in third place, you know, on Champions League course with Sebastian Hoeneß in charge, doing brilliant things week in, week out, and is almost getting ignored for it. And maybe for them, that's a great place to be at because, you know, with less attention, no one is really paying too much attention to them, but, or like, you know, gives them the ability to do whatever they want to do. But yeah, I think where Hoffenheim are right now, I think that's incredible. They have done an amazing job at that club, and they could be, and I mean, they've been in the Champions League before, right? And I think they're silently pushing for that spot. That said, you know, I mentioned and alluded to it, from third to all the way down to ninth, all those teams are Champions League contenders, in my opinion.
Fairly open table, with a few exceptions. Greuther Fürth, I would say, not in the Champions League spots, but some other clubs are. What are Hoffenheim doing? I watched them. That's the first time I've watched them. I'll hold my hands up and say I had not watched them until this weekend when they played Augsburg, and I was very much paying attention to Augsburg in that one, less so Hoffenheim. But what are sort of the hallmarks of their style? What are they doing to get to the place they are, and how do they maintain that to finish in the Champions League spots at the end of the season?
Yeah, I think that's going to be the difficult task, right, to maintain it. And they've been playing a very progressive 3-1-4-2 formation. Ilas Bebo has been excellent. They don't really have that typical number nine, right? And they have done a lot of it without Kramaric being in his best form either. And Andrei Kramaric, of course, a player who has been linked to various bigger teams throughout his time in Hoffenheim. And so they have been having this fantastic run without him being in his best form. And Ilas Bebo has been one to watch. Wonderful player, really fast. Jorginho Rudota is another one. Munas Dabur. You know, it's a very progressive attacking style of football. And I think that's really what they have done well. They're just, Sebastian Hoeneß has an idea. He executes it and he sticks to those principles. And there's this wonderful German word that we say, Handschrift. You know, you can see handwriting. You can see his handwriting all over this team. In the same way that you saw it when he was in charge of Bayern Munich 2, where he got promoted to the Dritte Liga, right? The third division in German football. And, you see it here as well. There's a clear handwriting. There's a clear idea of how he wants to have his team play football. And he sticks to it no matter what the opponent is. And I think Sebastian Hoeneß is a coach to watch in German football because obviously, other people will notice that he has a clear idea of how to play and that he sticks to these principles and that he, despite having faced some obstacles in his first season, has made this club better.
And do you feel like Chris Richards deserves all of the credit for where they are or just most of all of the credit for where they are? I don't understand why you're laughing.
Been very good, right?
That's a very serious question. That's a very serious question and is not at all my red, white, and blue glasses that I'm asking from. Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Right. Okay.
Thank you. He deserves all the credit. Got that on record. I do appreciate that. Since I've taken us the American route, let's talk about a few other clubs. Let's go to Wolfsburg for a moment. There is no Ricardo Pepi. There is still John Brooks. Broad question. What's going on with John Brooks, Manuel? Let's talk about it. Is he going to renew? Is he going to be sold? Is he going to be allowed to leave? Any ideas what maybe has gone on there as to having in his coaches? So I guess like the bad books for a while, it seems like he's back. He plays this weekend, but I do not fully understand anything that is happening with John Brooks. So I leave it to you to help me make sense of it, slash make sense of it entirely.
I don't understand anything that's happening with Wolfsburg, period.
All right.
I have heard rumors that Brooks could come to MLS.
Interesting. Any club in particular? Cough, cough, St. Louis, cough, cough?
No.
Okay.
No, I haven't heard those details. You know, this is something that I'm working on and it's very, very loose. So don't radio me say, Manuel Fietz said he's coming to like MLS. It's like, no, it's still early stages. But Wolfsburg is just such an interesting club just in general because they seem to have done everything right. And then Schmadtke, the sporting director is Marcel Schäfer, of course, who has a US past as well by having played for the Tampa Bay Rowdies. Schmadtke, and this was Schmadtke's decision, sort of lets Glasner go to Frankfurt and replaces him with Mark van Bommel. And that was a terrible decision. And then he replaces van Bommel with Florian Kohfeldt. And I think that's a terrible decision as well, because Kohfeldt has, I don't understand why clubs are doing, making the same mistake. Why are they looking at a coach who hasn't worked out previously at another club and bring him in anyways, thinking that this time it will be better? I have some issues with the lack of creativity when it comes to German executives making decisions about coaching positions. I think German teams can do a lot better, period. And I just don't understand what's happening with that, because you're talking about a club in Wolfsburg that a few years ago had the same budget as Atletico Madrid. And, you know, they're not anywhere near Atletico Madrid.
No, they're not.
They should be, though, but when you look at up and down that squad, yeah, that's a really good team. It's a very good team. And they are so far below their potential. It's shocking. It's absolutely shocking. And it's so very frustrating, because you just want them to do well and you want them to use their potential. But then you have decision makers bringing in someone like Kohfeldt. And I just don't understand. Like, go and think outside the box. Why not bring in a foreigner? Bring in a fresh set of ideas to this. And maybe bring in someone who's actually capable of playing the same sort of football that Glasner has last year, which obviously worked. And yeah, it's very frustrating when you see it. It just shows to me that they have a very good eye for talent, but a very bad eye when it comes to making front office decisions and who to put in charge of managing the talent.
And it's very strange to look at the table and see that it's Wolfsburg 14th on 20 points, Hertha Berlin 1 point ahead of them, and then Borussia Mönchengladbach 1 point ahead of them. I did not have those three clubs as 12th, 13th, and 14th. No. If you were choosing, Manuel, which club would you, of those three, would you least want to play for? Who do you feel like is going to have a rough end of the season versus who might be able to turn it around and get some wins here and there? Because looking at Wolfsburg, I think they have not won a competitive game since November 6th. They're winless in their last 10 competitive games. They got a club-friendly win in the break over Paderborn. I'm sure that will make all the difference. But It feels like Wolfsburg would be the answer. But could be Gladbach, could be Hertha. I ask you, Manuel, which one would you least want to play for right now?
Well, Gladbach will definitely lose the next game now that they've beaten Bayern. That's just how the league works.
All right, so they're in some trouble.
And there's actually a good chance they're going to lose that next game, because it's Leverkusen, who I actually think at times have been very attractive to watch. And there's a lot of bad things happening in Gladbach. The whole Matthias Ginter and Dennis Zakaria. There was talk today that Zakaria is in talks with Manchester United. Potentially go there. It's heavily been, has been linked to Borussia Dortmund as well. Matthias Ginter has been linked to Inter Milan. And there's some talk that Gladbach might sell them both now for a low price to just get them out of the squad, because they don't want to renew, right? That's not good. And the whole situation with Adi Hütter, he was the wrong coach. Just was. So it's not the right replacement for Rose. And I think in Gladbach too, they have to stick with Adi Hütter, because COVID means that they can't finance sacking him, because they would have to pay him out. Which of course then leads to the fact that Ebel has recently spoken about bringing in investors, right?
Okay. It all connects. Now I get it. All right. So we'll see. If they were to change it up, though, if they were to have a manager change at Wolfsburg again, or at Gladbach, or even at Hertha, the next question for me is, do you think people are going to take a look at Jesse Marsch in the Bundesliga, or do you feel like he has to go elsewhere to sort of rebuild that reputation? Because it does feel, as you said, I think earlier, that it was like right club, right situation, but like wrong time, effectively. I think I'm misquoting you. Right person at the right club at the wrong time is what I wrote down. But it still did not go well. It's still an American, and I do feel like there is sometimes that stigma about American coaches. Do you think that Bundesliga clubs might take a run at Jesse Marsch, or do you think he's going to be taking an assistant gig somewhere else before that happens?
I think he would have been a great choice for Frankfurt. Of course, you know, now that they have chosen Glasner, it's hard to argue that they made a wrong decision.
Yeah.
And there he was in talks there as well. And then he himself pushed for the Leipzig move, is my understanding at least. And, you know, maybe that was just the wrong thing to do, because filling in Nagelsmann's shoes was always going to be difficult. And Nagelsmann has played such a different style than what is usually expected from Red Bull teams, right? That trying to reimpose the Red Bulls, the pure Red Bull style of football that Marsh stands for, onto a team that has played very differently the 2 years before was always going to be very hard. Whereas in Frankfurt or maybe even Gladbach, it would have been easier to do that in some ways because they had that handwriting all over them already. And yeah, you know, maybe Marsh followed Rose in Salzburg. Maybe it would have been easier for him to follow Rose in Gladbach. You know, because it's more similar of a style of play to what the players were used to. I personally would give him another chance. What maybe maybe plays into Marsh's hand when it comes to German football is that a lot of German executives are not creative enough to go for someone else.
So he'll fall back into a gig. Do you feel like there's any stigma from the Red Bull connection that is there a chance he's seen as sort of he functions in that Red Bull system, but out of that system, he might not, or if you ask him to do things differently, he might not work. Do you feel like there's any sort of issue there, or mostly is it just, yeah, he's a coach who didn't have that much success so far, so let's see what else is out there?
I mean, everyone is kind of playing that style of football anyways now, or a lot of teams are, and you know, that really, really attacking-minded, counter-pressing style of football is someone that everyone is trying to replicate. I mean, I told you earlier about Bradley Cannell, and they pointed that out. Bradley Cannell, of course, worked in the Red Bull system for years as well, and so a lot of people are trying to play that sort of football. And I think because of that, that's probably going to play into his hands, to be honest. That German teams like to play that really high risk attacking style of football and pay less attention maybe to defensive work, which is one of the issues that Marsh had in Salzburg already. And it really came to the forefront in Leipzig, didn't it? So maybe, it will be something that actually will play into his hands and give him another opportunity in Germany.
But in his absence, Domenico Tedesco has come in. Leipzig now ninth in the table. They did get a win this weekend. How much do you feel like has changed at Leipzig under Tedesco? Do you think he has done a good job of stabilizing so far? Do you think we'll see him there in the longer term, or is he more of a short-term appointment? I think his gig, as I saw it, his contract goes until June of 2023, which I wouldn't say is the longest-term appointment.
Mm-hmm. No, it's not. And I got called out this week because I suggested that Tedesco is a defensive-only coach. Yeah, he played a more attacking, progressive style of football during his time in Moscow. Fair enough. But we just didn't see that in Germany, did we? And it's no offense to the Russian Premier League. It's a very different league than the Bundesliga. And so I do think he's a defensive stability guy first and wants the defensive foundation to be a big part of his attacking style game. And I think the game against Mainz was excellent. There was a couple guys that really stood out for me, and that was Szoboszlai and André Silva. And Kunku, of course, has always been good, right? All season long. And for me, though, the fact that Szoboszlai and Silva got clicking, that's very good news for Leipzig, because they are two guys who they spend significant money on and were supposed to be a key part of this team going forward, and they need to click, because I think they paid about 50 million euros for them together, right? And that's a lot of money. And so that needs to work out. And I think if he can get those two going and keep Nkunku hot and find the defensive stability. And I really like the fact that he started Guardiola and Simakan in defense, who I actually thought were two very excellent signings. We're going to bring a lot of joy to Leipzig fans down the road. We just haven't seen it yet because Marsh just couldn't get them going. And then Tedesco didn't have maybe the time yet to get them going. But I think in terms of quality, I believe that Leipzig will finish in the top four.
And they are, I'm not sure how far off that they are right now, but that
it
does feel
points.
Like with the talent they have, the depth they have, they'll be able to sort of string those results together to get at the very least into that conversation. Mm. Do you envision them doing much business in January to kind of add to the squad and just get them a little bit more depth than they currently have? Or do you feel like they're going to kind of stick with the signings they had this summer and try to get the team to gel around Tedesco and then see what happens maybe in the summer?
I think they don't need to do much, to be honest, and I don't think they will. They have to just get the guys that they have right now, play consistent football, get the signings that they made in the summer consistently integrated into the squad. I think that there's a lot of work there already. And I think that is the number one objective for Tedesco. It's going to be interesting to see what they're going to do with Caden Clark. I think the rumor now and what's been suggested to me is that he's heading back to New York for at least till the summer to get playing time rather than sitting on the bench in Leipzig, which actually makes a lot of sense to me because the squad is there, is very deep. And I think for them, with them not being in the most comfortable position at the moment, I don't know how much time whether he's going to get the playing time that he needs to develop further, right? I think he's going to probably get that more under Struber at New York than he's going to get at Leipzig. I think it's going to be interesting to see if that's actually going to happen, but it sounds like he's going back on loan. And then, of course, you know, they're still very deep. Sidney Rebiger, he made his debut as a 16-year-old for them last match day. Seems like a very good talent. So, yeah. I think Tedesco has a lot of work to do with the players that he has in his disposition. So I think rather than actually adding, they might send some of the guys who are very talented out on loan to ensure that when they come back next summer, they come into a situation that is maybe a bit more comfortable.
We have gone long, as we tend to do, Manuel. I appreciate your being so generous with your time. I have a couple more questions. I will try to get through them quickly so that we don't have to take up too much more of your day. I did want to ask about Stuttgart, as long as we're talking about American managers. Pellegrino Matarazzo is still there. Stuttgart finished 9th last season, 45 points, a goal difference of +1. This season, they're 15th. Just ahead of Augsburg for the relegation playoff spot. They've taken 18 points from 17 games. Their numbers are not massively different, as I could tell, from this time last season. What do you think is the reason for their inability to match last season's standard in terms of where they were in the table, in terms of survival comfort? Ninth does not feel as attainable. That said, as we've talked about a couple different points, the table is more open than it might suggest. So maybe they're going to be comfortably mid-table, maybe they end up in a relegation battle, but what do you think will make the difference for Stuttgart? Why haven't they been able to match that sort of output from last year?
Sascha Kalajdzic was injured for a long time. He's coming back now, right? And they're going to slowly integrate him into the side. That's like a new signing for them. And, that a player who has been very, very important for them. And I think you have to remember how many injury problems Stuttgart had at the first half of the year. And then COVID on top of that, right? You already have a ton of injury problems. And then at times you're missing 6-7 guys with COVID. That's really difficult to navigate for a club like Stuttgart. And I think, honestly, I don't think they're going to be in trouble. I just don't see it. I just think that they're going to be the sort of team that, okay, now the guys are coming back. Everyone is vaccinated now. They had the virus. A lot of people in Germany are getting their boosters. 50% of the population is boosted, right? So you're not going to miss as much time anymore at this stage. And I think that's going to help them in the second half of the season. They essentially just need to replicate what they did in the first year where they had all this first half of the season where they had all these issues and they're going to be fine, right? Silas Katombo Mvumbo is coming back as well. We talked about him a little bit last time. He was known under a different name previously, but there was issues, of course, with his agents and his passport and so on. He's a great player, and he's coming back as well. So I think when all their players return and once they get into full fitness and Kalajdzic starts clicking again, I think they will be just fine. And it's interesting too, because there is no talk about Pellegrino Matarazzo being in trouble as well. There's nothing. It's quiet. It's very quiet around him, which of course indicates to me that the decision makers at Stuttgart are very much aware of the difficulties he's been dealing with and therefore are just leaving him alone to do his thing because they have the confidence to know that he's going to turn things around.
All right, so we can feel better about at least one American in the Bundesliga. I would feel better about the Bundesliga if FC St. Pauli were to return. They are currently top of the Zweite Bundesliga. 18 games into the season, they are, I think, on top by 1 point ahead of Darmstadt and just ahead of Hamburg as well. Do you think we'll see everyone's favorite punk rock club back in the top flight next season, Manuel?
Oh, I mean, that would be fun. Maybe both Hamburg teams will go up.
Awesome. I would enjoy a Hamburg derby. So, but if you were betting money on one club to get promoted, would it be FC St. Pauli or would it be somebody else?
Oh my God. The Zweite Bundesliga really? Is so unpredictable. I think it's the most difficult second division in the world in terms of where you're going to end up at the end of the season. Because from top to bottom, it's the financial gap is almost nil. It's super competitive in a sense that everyone has the same spending power, which makes it, of course, a really interesting league to follow, right? Because you don't know what's going to happen. Everyone plays against for promotion and relegation at the same time. You can literally be in the top three one year and then fighting against relegation next year. It's so tight. So with that in mind, we're only at the halfway point. You need 60 points to go up. That's sort of been the benchmark. St. Pauli have 36, you know, so you can do the math. I think that Hamburg and Schalke are going to push hard. Hamburg need to go up. I mean, it's they're at the point now where they've been down there for so long that if they don't do it soon, it's going to be a really big issue for them. So they're going to push hard to go up. Same with Schalke. Schalke have so many financial problems that for them to not go up this year, it would actually really, really hurt them. And so those two teams will push St. Pauli all the way. I mean, in an ideal world, you will have two of Hamburg, Schalke, and Bremen go up. We need those blue chip clubs back in the Bundesliga. And that's just the bottom line. You know, we need less Fürths, Augsburgs, and Bielefelds in the Bundesliga, more Hamburgs, Bremens, and Schalkes, and even Nürnbergs in the league, because they have the big stadiums, they have the big fan attendance, and they bring the television money. And, you know, as harsh as that sounds, they are Germany's blue chip clubs, and they've just been so poorly run for so long that we want to have them up. That said, I exclude St. Pauli from that conversation because St. Pauli is in Hamburg.
Yeah.
You know, Hamburg is Germany's second largest city. It's, together with Munich, the richest city in Germany. And, having a team in Hamburg, whether it's HSV or St. Pauli, doesn't really matter as long as there is a team from Hamburg in the league, if that makes sense. So, and St. Pauli are great. I mean, they're right downtown, on the Reeperbahn. Hamburg SV, their stadium is a little bit further out. But yeah, St. Pauli would be, I mean, we would all love it, right? To see them in the league. And I think it would be even better to have both HSV and St. Pauli in the league. I think the big cities, the league would actually be better served if, the big cities had more than one team. And I'm not saying that because I'm an 1860 fan, but I think the league, was a better place when we had more derbies, inner city derbies. And I mean, you include Schalke in that too, because that would bring you back to Dortmund Schalke derby as well, right? The league is a better place when you have, two teams in Berlin, two teams in Hamburg, two teams in Munich, and, a couple of big teams in the Ruhrport that, you know, produce these big matches week in and week out.
So that always draws attention, and then so too do signings. My final question for you right now, I believe I'm correct in saying that Ricardo Pepi is far and away the most expensive signing in the Bundesliga in the January window. I think in terms of incoming signings, Hugo Sique signing for Freiburg for about $5 million is the closest to Pepe. How much do you think that will change? Do you think Pepe stays the most expensive acquisition in January? Do you think someone else will rival him? Do you think one of the larger clubs needs to strengthen in that way? Do you think he stays top five? I'm wondering how much you think there will be business done in January from the Bundesliga.
Yeah, I don't. I mean, if I would put money down, I think Ricardo Pepi has the chance to be the biggest. And, you know, there is rumors about Cecchino Dest coming maybe to Germany. I don't know.
You're not into it?
Yeah. Barcelona asking for a lot of money, and he hasn't really shown to any club who's interested in why they should spend a lot of money on him. So that is, of course, a big issue, right? If you're a team that wants to sell and the asset that you have has dropped significantly in market value, then
it's fair.
That's an issue. I don't know. It's going to be. I could see Pepe being the biggest transfer for any club this winter in the Bundesliga. I mean, maybe a couple outgoing guys, and then we'll see what that will do. You know, there has been some rumors about Mohamed Ali Cho going to Leipzig from I'm going to butcher my French here, Angers to SEO Angers to Leipzig, and his market value is around 12 million euros. So we'll see whether he's actually going to make the move and how much that's going to be. But is that going to be more than what Pepe cost? Maybe. And then Frankfurt are very, very, very interested in Josef Demir, the Austrian, who was on loan at Barcelona, and then Barcelona couldn't find the money to make that deal permanent and they had to send him back. So it would be interesting to see how much Frankfurt are willing to spend for that. But again, is that going to be more than Pepe? I don't know. I don't think so. So he has a good chance of being the most expensive.
There we go. All right. Well, if there were to be some business done, I'm assuming people can find it on Transfermarkt, which is where Manuel spends most of his time, but also check out the Gegen Pressing podcast as well. Manuel, thank you so much for taking so long to talk all things Bundesliga with me today.
Oh, it's so much fun. I always enjoy it. And
listeners, thanks so much for listening. I can't wait for you all to listen to another episode with me and Manuel and more episodes with me and the rest of the crew. We'll be back tomorrow doing some listener questions. But for now, thank you again for listening, and we'll talk to you again very soon.
Cheers.